to everyone out there. This is Sue Yan with the March 2026 Red Journal podcast. To me, March is a really beautiful time when the snow starts to change to the spring, and this always makes me feel philosophical. So for this discussion, I wanted to focus on our newest special section in the journal called Real Talk on Wellness. RTOW was inspired by a lot of things I saw during and after the COVID pandemic. I saw a lot of burnout come to the surface during the pandemic. And I also saw a lot of organizational and institutional efforts to address burnout, many of which seemed so well-meaning, but ended up falling short. And then, as we came out of the pandemic, I started to hear about friends and peers of mine who were just not doing well. We had editors here at the journal who were really strung out, and it felt like a true need, and I really wanted to find people who could write bluntly and plainly to our radiation community, free of any actual or even perceived agenda. So I asked people to write some short essays for the RTOW section, describing their perspective on wellness and what strategies they might suggest for radiation-oriented professionals hoping to stay well. So for this pod, I'm excited to host a few of our authors from this brave new section to talk about their essays. First of all, hello to Dr. Dan Golden. Dr. Golden is associate professor and vice chair for education in the Department of Radiation Oncology at Rush University Medical Center. He is the author of our newly published RTOW essay this month called After Burnout, Reigniting the Flame. Hi, Dr. Golden.
Hi, Dr. Yam. It's great to be here. Thanks so much to you and the Red Journal for inviting me to participate.
Thank you so much for your beautiful essay. I'm also super pleased to host Dr. Marie Soller, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the Oregon Health and Science University. She is the author of one of our first RTOW essays called Self-Compassion and Help-Seeking in Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Soller.
Thank you so much. Thanks for bringing this topic to your audience and having me join in.
And welcome to Dr. David Feldman, Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University, currently a visiting professor at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. Dr. Feldman is co-author of our essay just published online called Hope Mapping as a Tool for Mitigating Burnout in Radiation Oncology.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Yam. It's really an honor to be with you.
Okay, Dr. Golden, let's start with your very moving personal essay, which published in the March print issue. I hope I do justice to it by saying it is an essential recounting and reflection on a time in your life when you were struggling with burnout to the point of leaving your profession and the possibility of never coming back. Could you tell us, first of all, how did you end up writing all this down? Did you have a thought at the beginning that this was something you wanted or intended to share with other people?
Sure. I started writing it down fairly early in my burnout recovery process when I was participating in a partial hospitalization and intensive outpatient psychotherapy program. And I think pretty early as I started writing it down, I did envision sharing it. I cite a couple examples in my essay of others who shared their experiences with burnout or other wellness-related issues such as substance abuse. And I looked to them and felt that it was maybe a little bit of a roadmap that I could follow. And I felt that maybe by sharing my own experience, I could help others in the future potentially find a path through burnout. I think as I started writing it down, I also found it helped me organize my thoughts around what I was doing, where I'd been, and where I wanted to be going in the future.
And did you actually think you were going to publish it?
I wrote it and did start submitting it towards the end of my first 4 months off. And if you read the essay, you'll see that I actually ended up taking another 2 months or so off after returning to work for several weeks. At that point, I had submitted it to the Red Journal, and you had kindly reached out and expressed interest in publishing it. And I actually put a pause on it and said, please hold off. I wasn't at a point where I felt comfortable publishing it because I wasn't sure how my recovery was progressing and whether or what the end result was going to be. And So you graciously allowed me to kind of pause, and then I rewrote it again last summer after returning to work and feeling like I was in a much better place. But yeah, I mean, I guess early on I did plan to publish it and felt that it would be a meaningful addition to the literature on burnout, giving this kind of personal perspective rather than maybe a study. You know, there's lots of studies looking at burnout in physicians and survey responses and percent burnout in the workforce. But I thought the kind of case report, so to speak, would be beneficial as well.
Thanks, Dr. Golden. And I think that's such a beautiful illustration of how writing itself can be a process that enhances self-understanding and self-knowledge. I did sense in our interactions that you were actually working through things through the piece. And so I just really want to express that I value that as a writer myself. And also thank you for being so kind and so frank in your personal discussions here. In retrospect, do you think there were warning signs that were occurring during the early part of your journey that might have indicated that you could be heading in a negative direction? And I know it's difficult to parse this out, but in retrospect, do you think anything could have been done earlier by yourself or others?
Yeah, I do recall getting extremely frustrated on the way to work a few years ago just because of traffic, which was something that I had dealt with since I started my job. And I think the level of frustration I was experiencing was probably a symptom of my overall stress level. I've described it to colleagues as well as I've talked to a lot of mentees about my experience. And I use the analogy of I felt like a fish tank and there were balloons inflating in the fish tank. And I kind of reached a point where the balloons were inflating, but there wasn't any room left in the fish tank. And maybe when I started feeling that, I should have been more proactive at scaling back on some of my commitments. You know, I talk about in the essay about kind of leaving a board's review website that I'd started, but that was pretty late in the process. You know, perhaps I could have requested a decreased clinical workload, or you know, potentially stepped away from some of the grants or other research projects that I had ongoing. But as I talk about in the essay, I realized also there wasn't ever really a good time to do that. And maybe it took reaching a certain kind of rock bottom to really make the decision that I needed to make some serious changes.
You know, that is such an incredible story that you just told. And I just want to say that fish tank, that visual for me is super powerful. And I think the reason that I feel that is because it so much reflects how in a physician's life, and you know, the traffic story as well, how in a physician's life there are these frustrations. And it feels to me a little bit like you're alluding to that, which is the connection between sort of frustration and then the sort of, you know, lashing in, as you call it, right? It's a funny relationship between those two. And yeah, that's just very, very powerful, because I think all of us as physicians working in, you know, high acuity professions can relate to that feeling of those balloons closing in at times. And so I just want to thank you for that.
Yeah, and you know, as I think about it more, I guess another symptom maybe that in hindsight I should have recognized was getting very frustrated by small tasks. You know, for example, ordering a PET scan and feeling like it was almost this insurmountable task to get a PET scan done because it was going to take some extra effort to get it done promptly and expeditiously. You know, I think the frustration with little things in life that you know shouldn't frustrate you maybe was a symptom that I could have recognized earlier.
Yeah, totally agree with that. Totally agree with that. And the other thing that I thought was really important from your essay was that you described sort of procrastination behaviors where you were engaging in sort of meaningless or repetitive activities rather than actually addressing the things that were problematic for you. And I find that That is also a common behavior I see in myself and my peers, is that when you're overwhelmed, you just sort of start, you know, playing solitaire on the computer or whatever. And I also want to thank you for that insight. I guess one thing I would ask for you, and maybe we can bring Dr. Soller in here, is when do these behaviors, which are quite common and which I think many of us would relate to in Dr. Golden's piece, when do they become maladaptive, or when do they even become dangerous? Any insights on that, Dr. Golden or Dr. Soller?
I really agree with what Dr. Golden is talking about regarding the challenge of missing those early warning signs. I think Dr. Golden is a tremendous example of so many physicians who give their heart and soul to medicine because of how much they connect with the mission. They care about their patients, colleagues, learners. They want to move the science forward. And often it is very enjoyable to work hard, and they, folks thrive with new challenge and new learning. And it's hard to notice when we cross that line into the, you know, saying yes and adding more balloons to the fish tank is actually doing more harm than good. I think also there's a lot of wishful thinking that we all engage in, that maybe our fish tank can just get a little bit bigger. We want to say yes. We want to help the person that is asking for help, or say yes to that invitation to join the next committee or take the leadership role within the residency program. And I think physicians are really much more comfortable in figuring out how to absorb, how to make it happen, how to put the head down and do the grind to make it happen, versus saying, oh, you know, I think this might be too much. And so I would argue, actually, it's not only important to notice the early warning signs of irritability or feeling like the job is really a chore, you know, these really common signs that we're getting burned out, but being even more proactive about that. Like, how do I want to go about deciding whether or not I take on this project or not? But this is really hard in the culture of medicine, you know, and I think it's actually something we could be thinking about encouraging each other and encouraging learners to think about, you know, how do you manage yourself as a resource, a finite resource with a finite amount of cognitive energy, emotional energy, time, and be more proactive about distributing that energy.
So this is an interesting thing I see, Dr. Soller, which is that I think in some ways this speaks a little bit to the known generation gap in medicine. Because as you say, there are countless generations in medicine where put your head down and make it happen has been the ruling ethos. And I guess one question is, you know, knowing that no job is perfect and people aren't going to be, or no life is perfect and people aren't going to be peaceful and calm and in control of every molecule of their emotional well-being 24 hours a day. At what point does that cross the line? How do you know that this is happening too much? You're too frustrated, you're too hopeless, you're too paralyzed. How do you know when that line has been crossed? And then the second thing, which I think you just brought up again, is are there ways that other people can intervene and talk to you? I'd be interested in hearing from you, Dr. Golden, as to during that period, it's very sensitive, but would there have been a way for all the people who love you, because I know there are so many people who do, would there have been any channel for them to actually reach you or talk to you that would not have been rebuffed or insulted you?
I definitely had family and friends who would comment that they didn't understand how I was doing everything I was doing. And I would kind of laugh and say, I like to be busy. And, you know, I do love what I do. And I love the clinical work. I love research and teaching. I also love my family and everything they get to do in my personal life. I think at some point a few years ago, I just had no slack left in the system. And that was where the problem really stemmed from, was when little things would happen that I wasn't anticipating or that added just a little extra effort. They became very frustrating and difficult to deal with in my personal life as well as in my professional life. And I did have a partner in my clinic who I think recognized how busy I was and would check in with me from time to time. And I would say, no, I'm okay. I'm doing fine. It's just been a long day. You know, I think at a certain point, it's the individual that has to kind of come to the realization that it's a problem and they have to deal with it. There's only so much that somebody from outside can do. You know, I think if my chair or someone had said, oh, I'm going to take you off a grant because you seem too busy, I would have been offended by that and probably would have said, no, I'm fine. Like, you don't need to do that. So, you know, I want to be clear. I don't blame anybody for my situation. I think it was, you know, I'm an adult and I made personal decisions to take on roles and projects and clinical work. And in the end, it was on me to recognize when I was overstretched, and it just got beyond my control and to the point I needed to take a leave to really reset things.
Dr. Soller, any thoughts on that?
I do think that as we cultivate more of an ability to do self-reflection, mindfulness, you know, that ability to recognize, hey, or take our temperature, you know, how am I doing? What's going on? How am I feeling at the end of the day? How am I able to show up for my family and my patients? That is a really powerful tool for well-being. Being able to check in with oneself and do that kind of assessment. I think when we're doing that too, it is easier to hear other people's concern as not, hey, I think you have a character flaw here, but oh wow, I'm noticing how hard you're working. You know, are you sure? Are you sure you're okay? Because it's all right if you're not okay, and I'm here to help. But I think this is a big challenge for most, the majority, if not all physicians, to have that openness, that curious, the compassionate curiosity about oneself to take a close look and to realize when we need to pull back a little bit, or even to pull back before that need is urgent and say, okay, I could do that. But I anticipate that I'm going to get burned out by the end of this year if I say yes. So even before you're feeling exhausted and burned out and irritable, to cultivate that skill in being able to anticipate how to take care of yourself moving forward. I think Dr. Golden's description, there's nothing unusual about his experience and that because it is just so difficult to notice those early warning signs. And I think we are so susceptible to wishful thinking when it comes to taking on tasks that we deeply care about. And so it's really a shared responsibility. I think it's the individual's responsibility to cultivate that compassionate curiosity. And for all of us in medicine, to be thoughtful about it and elevating the conversation with colleagues and learners as well.
Dr. Golden actually discusses in his essay how he was applying some of the questionnaires that were coming from his institution to himself. And I remember you said that I wished I could answer no to those questions, but I found myself answering yes more and more frequently. Are there similar self-assessment tools that you might recommend, Dr. Feldman or Dr. Soller, that people could use in a similar manner to assess where they're at?
Well, there are a number of self-assessment tools. I mean, we're all familiar probably with the Maslach Burnout Inventory, which is sort of the gold standard for measuring burnout in the field of medicine. Also, I'm going to be talking a little bit later about HOPE, because as I'm listening to this, I think that in response to your earlier question, Dr. Yam, when do you know when things have sort of crossed over into a sort of dangerous area, or you sort of start to look at yourself and say, maybe I need to see to my level of burnout or take care of myself in a slightly different way, is when you start to feel, in the context of work, a little bit hopeless. And what I mean by that is that you start to look at your work and say, maybe my efforts don't matter. Maybe, in fact, the goals that I've been trying to achieve for so long aren't as important as they used to be, or maybe my ability to achieve them is hampered in a way that makes me less effective than I'd like. And you start to lose a sense of pride or a sense of enjoyment, if you will, in your work. And this creeps up really, really slowly. I think this happens before we experience the full-blown syndrome of burnout. And so there's also an inventory called the Hope Scale or the Adult Hope Scale, which you can get copies of online, which people can fill out. It takes about 5 minutes. It's about 8 questions. So I think there are lots of different assessments, but I honestly think the best assessment we can do is to do what Dr. Soller said earlier, which is just to spend 5 minutes, maybe close our eyes, maybe it's at our desk, maybe it's at home, and we just take our temperature. We ask ourselves, how do I feel in my body? Am I carrying a lot of tension? Do I feel heavy in my stomach? Am I feeling hopeless? Am I feeling sad? Am I feeling stressed out or strung out? How do I feel in the morning when I get up and go to work? I really think that just by taking a few minutes to honor our own internal experience, which honestly, in our hard-hitting careers, we often learn to put on hold, but if we can dial that back in, I think that's better than any formal assessment that we can do in the context of our own lived experience.
Dr. Soller, what's your favorite question to ask yourself?
What Dr. Feldman is saying resonates with me quite a bit. I think that self-reflection and building that into one's daily practice is so powerful. And it doesn't have to be fancy. And you can make it up yourself. You know, one exercise I like to suggest and do myself is at the end of the day, when you're transitioning from work to home, to do a little body scan and notice head to toe, how are you feeling? Where's the tension? How's your mood? How's your energy? And I also like to complement that with a three good things exercise. So thinking, okay, what happened today? Let me think about this. And what are three good things that happened? And how did I contribute to those things? So helping to redirect your attention to the positives. And they don't have to be huge. It doesn't have to be whose life did I save today? It might be who did I make smile? Or was I able to explain that concept in a way that my resident really understood it? Or could I show up and be really present and listen to that patient and family? So complementing that self-check-in with an attention to what's going well. I think we're really wired to notice what's not going well. You know, what went wrong? Where did I fall short? What's still on the to-do list that I didn't finish? And it takes some training to redirect and bring towards what's going well. And I think that can be another, almost a type of self-assessment in itself. If you're finding it really, really challenging to come up with three good things, or how you contributed to those three good things, that might be a sign that you need to take a break or ask for some help.
Fantastic range of ideas here. And, you know, I think everyone can try to find something in all of that that they like the best. Dr. Golden, I'd like to go back to your piece where you talk about therapy and pottery and golf as very deliberate activities that you're now using as tools to maintain your wellness. What do these things do for you that's so helpful? And can you describe how you're committed to them now as a result of your past experience?
Yeah, I do think that the three good things exercise, I just want to echo that, is something that I've used. And I find at times I forget or I can lose that ability to recognize the good things that have happened during the day. And golf and pottery and even therapy certainly are opportunities to reflect. You know, there's a lot of time on the golf course where I'm walking, even if I'm playing with friends. There's a lot of me time when I'm searching for my ball in the bushes somewhere because I'm not that great of a golfer. Or I'm at pottery. There's a lot of folks around, but in the end, it's kind of me and the clay, and there's a lot of me time there as well. And then certainly therapy, you know, having a good therapist can help with kind of positively reframing life. I was thinking about pottery and golf, and, you know, one thing that happened to me You mentioned at the introduction of the podcast how you noticed burnout and stress kind of coming to the surface after COVID. But prior to COVID, I was pretty dedicated to CrossFit. I would go almost every morning before work. And when COVID hit, that all kind of came to a pretty abrupt end. And I started exercising in my attic in my house. And in reflecting on that, and now with golf and pottery, there's a concept called the third space. So the first two spaces are home and work. And the third space is kind of a place where people come together. It could be church, synagogue, mosque. It could be a public park. It could be a gym. For me, I think I've kind of rediscovered that third space with golf and pottery. You know, I go to the pottery class, and it's really me and mostly a bunch of middle-aged women. But I really enjoy it. We chit chat. They ask about my son's bar mitzvah. You know, we talk about their kids in college, and it's an opportunity just to take a break from the rest of life. And similarly, on the golf course, even if I play by myself, I meet other people in my foursome, and we chat about things completely unrelated to work or family. And it's an opportunity for my brain to just take a rest. And then there's, like I said, there's time in there where I do have moments of self-reflection that I think maybe was missing for a few years.
Yeah, I love that, Dr. Golden. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think so much of what you're saying is so relatable to me, at least, and I hope at least to some people out there listening. And I also think about the concept of time. You know, you have these different kinds of time. And I often think that the time I spend with myself feels so much deeper and more meaningful in some ways than a lot of the other time in my life. And I just worry that I'm not spending enough time with myself sometimes. And it strikes me that a lot of what you're talking about is sort of that rest time for your brain when you're really just processing and thinking and focusing on your own place in the universe. So anyway, thank you for sharing that. So moving.
Yeah, maybe I'll also add, I think for those of us that work a lot, some of us may use work as a kind of third space where we socialize with our peers and our colleagues. And that was also something that I felt I lost when COVID hit with, you know, the move to virtual work and kind of hybrid arrangements where people come in, they do their work, and maybe on the days that they're not in clinic, they're otherwise not present. And this doesn't just apply to physicians, you know, administrative staff who used to be around 5 days a week suddenly aren't around. And I think I lost some of that fun banter that also broke up the daily grind of work. And for me personally, moving institutions in the end was good. I'm glad I made the move. I'm very happy with my new job, but it was a much harder transition than I anticipated. And a lot of that stemmed from kind of having to reestablish that social network at work, which is just harder after the pandemic with virtual work.
I agree. And you hear that a lot from people, just sort of inside comments, the idea that we've lost camaraderie or we've lost some sort of team or family spirit that we used to have pre-COVID with all this hybrid and virtual work. I agree. And it's especially hard, I notice, for new people who come into a group to establish those relationships without the personal interaction. So again, you know, so profound what you're talking about and so universal to so many, I think, right now. Let's bring Dr. Soller back in here a little bit because I want to go to her theme on self-compassion. I think we've sort of skirted around that and touched on that here and there, but I'd like to really just talk about that and have you explain why you think it's important in the context of burnout. How does one develop self-compassion?
I do think self-compassion is a really critical ingredient in well-being and something that physicians in general are a little lacking on. And when I'm talking about self-compassion, I'm leaning on some of the ideas of some previous academics. Kristen Neff is a psychologist who has written extensively on the topic of self-compassion. She defines it as a combination of how we talk to ourselves, so how kind or unkind are we with our own self-talk, mindfulness, being able to slow down and check in with oneself and take our temperature, as others are saying, and then also remembering our common humanity. And I think this gets a bit at what Dr. Golden is saying too about what was lost in the COVID pandemic when we didn't get to have those small side conversations with folks at work, but remembering that we are connected to each other, leaning on each other, and also that we are just human. We are imperfect, but also, you know, quite amazing too. So being able to cultivate those three parts of self-compassion offers more resiliency. It is really compatible with more of a growth mindset, where we're thinking about what are we putting into our work, not being overly dependent on the outcome, you know, whether or not we get that promotion or that grant is funded, or we have the patient outcome that we're hoping for. Physicians tend to have unrealistic high expectations for themselves. So they get really focused on the outcome and quite disappointed and feel quite guilty when even unrealistic expectations are unmet. So, you know, I think cultivating self-compassion, again, is a shared responsibility. So cultivating self-compassion comes not just from the individual, but also from our organizations and colleagues, and helping each other to think about setting realistic expectations, you know, absolutely striving for excellence to do the best that we can, but being very mindful of our human nature and our, you know, our imperfect nature, and then celebrating ourselves and each other along the way. There's an elevated conversation as well about shame in medicine. And I think this is a really critical concept to consider, because for, you know, decades, we have used shame in medicine as a motivator, either to motivate ourselves or motivate each other. And I think of self-compassion as the exact opposite of that, where we're trying to motivate ourselves towards something positive that we're trying to accomplish. We're enlisting our resources to do so, versus shame. We're not motivating ourselves out of fear that we're going to fail or disappoint somebody or hurt somebody. So noticing how we talk to ourselves and others and really trying to motivate towards that positive is an important way to cultivate self-compassion.
Thank you so much. And just for the nerds out there, all the science nerds who listen to our podcast, what does the published literature show about self-compassion? What are the effects on oneself and others?
We could talk for hours and hours on this topic. What one really interesting study that might be relevant to listeners was done by Mickey Trockel, a psychiatrist and academic at Stanford. And he used this concept of self-compassion highlighting an additional component, which is the deferral of self-care. So how likely are physicians in particular to defer self-care, to, you know, squeeze in that next patient before you go to the bathroom, even though you really have to go to the bathroom, or stay a little bit later to finish all those emails so you get those deadlines done, but that means you might miss dinner with your partner. So this self-compassion with this self-deferral, he looked at this and measured it in physicians and non-physician professionals. So matched professionals in the community who were also working very hard, long hours, high-achieving folks. He found, unsurprisingly, I think most of us would guess this, that physicians are more burned out than matched professionals in the community. But when he controlled for self-compassion with this deferral, self-care deferral component, he found that actually physicians were less burned out than matched professionals, suggesting that a major driver of burnout amongst physicians was this low self-compassion and the deferral of self-care. He replicated this study and looked at, okay, well, how can we work on self-compassion and improve this among physicians? And, you know, things like mindfulness, education around self-care, cognitive strategies to focus on the positive. And he found that when you can make improvements in self-compassion, which is a wonderful finding to know that we can make progress on this, but that actually has a positive result, leads to a reduction in burnout, which is really exciting. So for me, that absolutely underscores the importance of cultivating self-compassion amongst ourselves.
What beautiful sentiments. And Dr. Soller, I really liked in your article that you addressed the personal development of self-compassion, but you also put some responsibility for this on institutions, and you called for a culture change in medicine that institutions and leadership should support. Could you describe your thoughts on this?
Absolutely. Tate Chenefelt, who is another prominent academic in the area of physician well-being, describes it really beautifully, in my opinion. So he calls for a culture change from perfectionism to striving for excellence with self-compassion and growth mindset. And I think that as an individual, to work on that mindset change, we require that those around us and our institutions and our cultures are doing that same work. So this is not the same thing as sloughing responsibility or only operating at 60%. This is really about still trying to work hard towards something quite amazing and powerful and patient care and learning, but doing it in a way where we're understanding that we are human, we need to refuel, we need each other to support each other in doing this, and we need to be able to see our progress, so be celebrated for our progress, both being able to celebrate ourselves and also celebrate each other. And I think this is something we can do as we examine our language as leaders and educators, how we're talking to each other and how we talk to ourselves. And again, really trying to promote our goals being towards something positive versus away from something that we're afraid of, and acknowledging we need each other and we're in this together and can help each other thrive in this way.
I really hope a lot of people are listening to this, because I do really feel that that culture change is so difficult when you talk about language or celebrating certain accomplishments or individuals. It feels like self-compassion would be swimming a little bit upstream. Any thoughts on that? How do we actually institute that kind of culture change?
I agree. Some days it does feel like we're swimming upstream. On the other hand, I've also seen how effective cultivating more self-compassion can be. And, you know, I really have to believe that people are going to, and organizations are going to learn to understand that. I do think in general, and you alluded to this, Dr. Young, there are some generational changes in medicine and how individuals are approaching medicine, where earlier generations might have been more accepting about putting their head down and working hard and sacrificing so much for the job and deferring self-care. I think younger generations aren't going to be quite as accepting of that. Right now, I feel we're in a little bit of a culture clash, but I think looking at how can we see the goal of thriving as an individual and doing really excellent work, where's the common ground? You know, thinking of those as not mutually exclusive, but looking for ways that they complement each other. For instance, in trainees, when trainees are given opportunities to learn and to do meaningful work, the amount of energy and effort and burnout is lower because they feel like they matter and they're making a difference and they're operating in line with their values. And so, you know, learning this from the perspective of an educator and a leader is really just about paying attention and noticing how much more effective and powerful it is to motivate with towards the positive with a lot of self-compassion. So, you know, I think this podcast is a really wonderful way to move the culture. Dr. Golden's sharing his story is an incredible way of changing culture. Dr. Feldman's work around hope. I think all of these are, we're doing the hard work. It is a pretty big ship to change course, but I think we can do it.
Well, I think we're actually starting to touch on another concept that I find really fascinating, which is the concept of self-efficacy and maybe associated to that joy in work, which I think is leading us really beautifully into Dr. Feldman's article. So, Dr. Feldman, I do feel like your article put some very complimentary messages out to where this conversation is going. You and your co-author, Dr. Korn, described a very concrete process called hope mapping. And tell us a little bit about how you see the concept of hope relating to this conversation and why you think it's important in burnout.
Yeah, I'm deeply interested in the concept of hope because I see it as this sort of central psychological asset that we have that drives a lot of what we do and keeps us going even when things are hard as human beings. I mean, if you think about it, life's pretty hard. Work is difficult, not to mention our social life, our romantic life, you know, raising kids, keeping a home. All of these things are hard to do. And why would we do any of them unless we had at least some hope that our efforts mattered, that they would lead somewhere that is meaningful or important for us? So I really think that hope is this central idea in our lives that we have to cultivate. This kind of quiet motivator that's important in so many different things that we do. And you mentioned the hope mapping tool. The hope mapping tool is really one technique in a larger intervention called hope therapy, or if you will, the hope workshop that I developed about 15 years ago. And then my collaborator, Dr. Ben Korn, and his wife, Devorah Korn, have sort of taken and developed a little bit further. And the hope intervention is really based on a model of hope known as hope theory, which says in a nutshell that hope thrives when three conditions are met in our lives. And there's now 450 studies, by the way, and quantitative measures to back up what I'm about to say. But these are three very simple conditions. But I think we're talking about this whole interview, it's often the really simple things in life that give our lives meaning, the really simple things in life that we know we should do that we often don't do in our hard-hitting careers and in our busy lives. So those three conditions are, first of all, having goals. So it may seem obvious, but having something to hope for. And we know from really hopeful people that it's really important to have at least some goals in our life, even small ones. They're actually intrinsically meaningful to us. And we all know that in our busy lives, we can easily have goals that we're working on 24/7 that are things we have to do rather than things that we really want to do or are personally meaningful. And also, I think we tend to get very unbalanced in our lives. We tend to think about goals as falling into our sort of career lives, but we can often, and we should often, really think about goals as falling into every area of our life, our avocational lives, our hobbies, our family life, even our spiritual life are important sources of goals. So that's goals. The second condition, which really relates to hope mapping, which is what you asked about, is pathways. So a pathway is simply a route, a strategy, some way that we envision that we can get from where we are to our goals. So in hope interventions, we do the really unromantic work of getting out a sheet of paper, or we also have an app for this. And the app guides people to identify what is an area of their life they want to work on. What is a meaningful goal that they can set in that area, even a small goal? And why is it truly meaningful? And then to begin to map out steps that they can take, step one, step two, step three, and to do something that people often don't like to do, which is to anticipate how they can get sidetracked. What are those obstacles that can stand in the way? Because there are a number of studies now that show that one of the best ways of inoculating ourselves against getting sidetracked in the goals that are meaningful in our lives is to anticipate what are those obstacles and how can we sort of pre-plan around them. And so you can use the Hopetimize app for this, which we've developed, or you can just do it on a sheet of paper. And then the final condition for hope to thrive is agency, which is kind of a funny psychology term. But in this context, it really just means the energy or the motivation we need to go after this goal or goals that are meaningful to us. And this is really unique to each person. For some of us, this sense of agency can come from our physical selves, you know, getting enough sleep, eating a healthy diet, getting exercise. For others of us, not everyone, it can come from our spiritual selves. So oftentimes people find prayer and meditation very, very good sources of agency and energy, but also maybe just sitting by the beach and watching the waves lap up against the shore, listening to an inspiring piece of music. Another source of agency for a lot of people is social support. The people in our lives that maybe we can think of as our cheerleaders, the people that believe in us even more than we do. Dr. Golden talked about some people in his life that played that role for him that I really think helped in his burnout recovery, or at least it sounds like it really did. And then another source of agency is, as Dr. Soller was talking about, the way we talk to ourselves. I think we can, in our hard-hitting careers, begin to think that to be effective, we have to talk to ourselves in really non-self-compassionate ways. You know, what's wrong with me? I need to work harder. But actually, the research is really clear, some of it by Kristen Neff and others, that shows that this really interferes with productive learning. It interferes with memory and executive functioning, that actually in the long term, talking to ourselves in more self-compassionate ways is actually a better source of agency or motivation. So goals, pathways, and agency. And we now have something like 450 studies and quantitative measures that really show that if we can cultivate these three simple things in our lives, it helps us feel more hopeful. But it also helps to lower depression, lower anxiety. It leads to better physical health. There's actually a study that we did recently, Ben Korn, Marie Bacaitis, and others, where we followed 500 patients with advanced cancer for 4 years and found that hope actually predicted survival. And in addition to that, it's highly, highly associated with lower levels of burnout. So I think hope is just such an important thing to intentionally cultivate in our lives.
So Dr. Feldman, I'm going to ask you maybe what's a little bit of a downer in the midst of all these beautiful sentiments. When Dr. Korn came on our podcast before, he described agency with a really interesting story about Michael Jordan. And he actually illustrated that by sort of talking about how Michael Jordan was very domineering in some ways and was really motivated by, you know, if I could summarize it, I don't think Dr. Korn used these exact words, but really ambition and dominance over others. So one of my questions is, you know, the hope mapping process doesn't necessarily come from the, you know, the sources of agency that you and Dr. Soller have been talking about. Sometimes it does come from motivations that are sort of more related to things like ambition and power. Mm. And is that part of the hope mapping process? My sense from having spoken with Dr. Korn is that this is really a neutral process and agency can come from a lot of different types of emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I think what motivates each person is really unique. And part of what we work with people on, and part of what I would encourage listeners to think about, is in their lives, where does that sense of motivation and energy or agency come from? But I also think you're hitting on something really, really important, Dr. Yam, which is to think about this in a sustainable way, right? Sometimes when I'm talking about this, people bring up things like, they say, well, I am motivated by things like anger, or I am motivated by anxiety. And I think that emotions like this can provide quick bursts of energy. And I don't mean to knock that. Sometimes being a little angry, being a little frustrated, being a little anxious can push us to do something we need to do. But I think in the long run, these kinds of motivations are short-lasting. They feel really bad, and they often flame out. And so we really encourage people to think about what are more long-lasting supports or sources or resources that people can use for agency. And I really think those are some of the things that I named. You know, thinking about taking care of your physical body so you have physical energy. Thinking about who are those cheerleaders in your life that can be sort of surrogate sources of agency when you're feeling down. So if I can self-disclose for a second, that's often, I'm very lucky, that's often my father. When I'm feeling low in agency, that third component for hope to thrive, I can often call my dad and he can encourage me. He can say words of support that lead me to believe in myself and get me a little bit reanimated, that can help me have more self-compassionate, more, I suppose, positive, motivating self-talk that helps me to have a more sustainable form of motivation. So I do think it matters where these things come from. And I think that relates to what the other guests on today's show are saying.
I really relate to that. I have a similar relationship with my parent, and I love that you're pinpointing the source of that as coming from absolute love. So, Dr. Feldman, the process of hope mapping, as you described it, is the actual exercise, and you even stated just a moment ago to write this down on paper. But I'm just imagining that, you know, even for me, when I think about writing something down on a piece of paper, I mean, especially in this day and age, it just feels very artificial. Is that necessary to do an app or write it down on paper? Or can people integrate the concept of hope into their lives more naturally? Is this something you can train yourself to do? Is it like a muscle that you can strengthen with repeated use?
I do think that hope is kind of like a muscle. It's a great metaphor. And I have to say, it's a muscle that we're used to flexing and that we've built up really well in the professional sphere of our lives. I mean, everyone listening to this podcast, because I'm assuming most of your listeners are radiation oncologists or at least medical professionals or healthcare professionals, have been through medical school, have been through graduate school, perhaps have been through residency, maybe fellowship. We wouldn't have gotten this far in our careers if we didn't have the ability to set these three conditions, goals, pathways, and agency in our lives. But I think that these sorts of skills can get very ossified in only the career sphere. And we forget to use them or don't give ourselves permission to use them or sometimes are very unpracticed at using them in other areas of our life, like with our hobbies, the things that we enjoy, like perhaps traveling, like with our family, with our kids, with our romantic relationships, with our friends. And in fact, I think a lot of people think we shouldn't have to think as systematically about these areas of our lives that we do about our work. And, you know, maybe that was true 100 years ago when life was perhaps less complicated, although I think life has always been complicated. But certainly in the year 2026, with all of the stresses of our jobs, working in the modern healthcare system, living in the world that we live in, with all of the pressures that we face and all of the inundation of information that we have, I think we actually need to bring these same skills into these other areas of our life. It's almost as if, to extend the muscle metaphor, we've really gone to the gym and we've really built up our upper body, but we haven't built up our lower body. And so part of what I really want to encourage people to do, whether they do it formally on paper or using the Hope2Mize app or any other app, or whether they simply do it taking a few minutes at their desk or while they're driving to work in their own mind, is to really think in a planningful, intentional way about what are those other goals in my life that perhaps have lain fallow for a while that I want to help to cultivate. Maybe it's even small things. Maybe it's just, you know, I really used to enjoy drawing or painting or piano, and I haven't done that in a while. And I really want to set a goal to get back to the piano and play for 15 minutes a day. You know, maybe it's something in our friendship life. You know what? I haven't cooked dinner and had friends over in a while, and that's a goal that I want to set. And then think a little more intentionally about what is the pathway to that? What are the obstacles that could stand in my way to begin to inoculate myself against that? And then what are the sources of motivation that can keep me going when I start to feel discouraged, when I start to feel the avalanche of other things blocking my path? But I do want to say one last thing. I do think writing it down is important, because I think if we only do this in our head, it becomes unprioritized, deprioritized in our life. If you think about it in the context of our work, we write everything down that's important, right? We do it in the electronic health record. We do it when we're sort of planning out meetings that we have with colleagues. We set an agenda, we write it out, we send it out on email. So I think doing a little bit of that in our own lives to honor ourselves, to keep us going, is actually really important. Even though it can seem like busy work, I think it pays dividends.
Okay, Dr. Feldman, one thing that came up in the review process was that your article describes how this focus on hope is different than just simple processes of identifying obstacles or setting goals. And I will say it gets a little confusing because identifying barriers, setting goals, and even finding agency to achieve things are actually an important part, I think, of the psychotherapy or coaching process. So how does the idea of emphasizing hope differ from psychotherapy or coaching, or how does it interact or draw from them? Might be interesting to hear from Dr. Soller as well.
Well, I mean, and Dr. Soller, you could add to this if you want. Psychotherapy or coaching are broad professions, right? And there's many models within those professions. So I always like to advise people that if you're going to seek coaching or if you're going to seek a psychotherapist, ask them what model they use. Ask them how they work with patients. It's a sort of like saying the profession of medicine, but of course there are lots of tools, models, interventions within that. And so hope or hope theory, this kind of tripartite model of saying that hope thrives when we set goals, when we have pathways and agency, is one such well-specified model that, as I mentioned, has many hundreds of studies behind it. And so really, this is a way of working, if you will, within coaching or within psychotherapy. But we've also trained, and I'm doing research now, where I'm training nurses to do this. I'm training non-clinically trained social workers, right? People who don't normally do psychotherapy to do this. I've trained professors and teachers and even college students to do peer delivery of hope interventions. So I think it's a model of how to think about leading to a healthier life. And also the advantage, I think, of a model like this is it produces quantitative tools that we can use to measure the outcomes of our interventions. But I do want to say one more thing, which is I do want to admit, and this gets to what Dr. Soller was talking about earlier, that I'm not pretending that simply working on our hope or our self-compassion or any of the other things we've talked about here is going to magically change this incredibly stressful system that we're in. Obviously, one of the root causes of burnout is the incredible intensification of work that has happened recently. We're being asked to do the jobs of what maybe two or three people would have done just 10 or 20 years ago. We've got incredible stresses and strains and pressures and oversight. And I think also the systems that we work within need to be changing, need to be introspecting, need to be making reforms as well. I don't think I think I'm speaking for the other guests, see these as mutually exclusive. While the systems are hopefully changing and while we can help to change them, I think we also need to see to our hope. We need to see to our own internal well-being at the same time.
If I can jump in there, I really enjoy this model that you've created, Dr. Feldman. I think that creating some scaffolding for people to do some mindful insight development and for cultivating a strategy for moving forward is so helpful. And I think it really is quite consistent with a lot of what we do in psychotherapy, a lot of what is presented in positive psychology from the beginning, setting value-based goals, goals that are meaningful and powerful to the individual. Thinking about the strategy. So how am I going to go about those goals? And where's my rocket fuel? Where's my agency? And recognizing when you set lofty goals that are going to be hard to accomplish, none of us can accomplish those goals by ourselves. So who are the helpers? How are we going to fuel ourselves to do this work? I think this is really consistent with what I'm often doing with physicians in psychotherapy. You know, I think sometimes people might choose to see a coach or a mentor or a close friend or a psychotherapist when they're feeling a little stuck, you know, when they're finding it hard to set reasonable goals, or they're feeling stuck with, gosh, what is the pathway? Or I don't feel like I have any agency. And asking for help at those times can be really powerful, you know, both to recognize, okay, it's normal that I can't figure this out on my own. And there are people out there who can help me to do that. I was thinking also, as you were speaking, Dr. Feldman, about anger and other maybe more charged or negative motivators, and how we might use those successfully in the short term, but they are likely to fizzle out because they're very costly motivation strategies. We always have these examples of people who seem to be doing it so successfully, like Michael Jordan. But for instance, I talk to a lot of physicians about striving for excellence and not using perfectionism. And even after I have met with somebody several times or given a talk for 60 minutes, I will very reliably have people say, well, you know, Dr. Soller, I hear you, but I really believe that my perfectionism is why I've been this successful. And if I let it go, I think I might fail. I might hurt somebody. I might not get that fellowship. I might not get that grant approved. And I counter with, you know, I think it's more possible that you've gotten this far despite your use of perfectionism as a motivation strategy. And thinking about the concept of agency as what else, what other motivators, what other strategies can you lean on besides perfectionism that are going to lower your risk for distress and actually increase your likelihood of being successful over the long haul, so that you can do this very challenging job over the course of your whole lifetime and thrive while you're doing it. And I would argue that determining the healthiest, most positive sources of agency, the pathways that are going to be most likely to help you achieve that, is a really wonderful way of thinking about that. And part of that is just recognizing we can't do it alone, and we need each other to help us along the way.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Soller, for giving us a different vision of Michael Jordan. I really appreciate you rescuing him there, because I was expecting a lot of blowback from all the Michael Jordan fans. And as a basketball fan myself, I love thinking about Michael Jordan in that way, in a sort of sustainable and really personally centered way. So thank you. We've discussed a couple of different things here, you know, deep reflection and timeouts, self-compassion, the deliberate cultivation of hope as some techniques to combat burnout. And I'll just say we didn't discuss time management and spiritual connectivity, which are two other topics that will be featured in the Real Talk on Wellness section. I'm curious if anyone here thinks there's other major constructs from the burnout literature that you would find related or important that would be worth mentioning. Or are there actually things you see being promoted in the anti-burnout literature that are potentially harmful?
Well, if I could just comment on time management for a second, I see time management strategies as helpful, but a little bit decontextualized. I mean, in a way, time management strategies are kind of simmering in the background of certainly the hope interventions that I've been involved in developing and delivering. You know, what often happens when I'm working with healthcare professionals or others is we begin to identify for people the sources of these sort of three conditions for hope to thrive, right? Goals, pathways, and agency. People begin to identify meaningful goals, maybe even outside of work, that they want to cultivate in their lives. But as we're identifying the steps to get there, the pathway, people identify time that they're too busy as an obstacle to that. And so we end up talking about time management strategies, but not in isolation. And I think one of the issues with simply giving people time management strategies is the question is, well, why am I managing my time? What meaningful outcomes am I moving towards? And what I've found just anecdotally in working with people who are often very burned out is that it's that sense of a loss of meaning, that I'm not working towards goals, or perhaps I am working towards goals that used to feel meaningful to me, but no longer do. There's a sense of, well, why am I even managing my time? For what am I doing this? And so I think when we do interventions having to do with hope, it always starts with centering ourselves in what is a meaningful goal that I'm hoping for or moving towards. And then time management strategies are sort of embodied and contextualized in a meaningful way. So I think time management's important, but I don't think it's a panacea by itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult balancing the very positive language and, you know, efforts I support and self-efficacy and productivity, which are sort of related to time management, against sort of the, you know, maybe what we would call person-centered constructs, like we've talked about here. And in some ways, I think that is part of the fundamental chasm or misunderstanding between institutions and the individuals who work within them. I'm not sure exactly how to formulate that better or bridge that in any way, but interested to hear people's thoughts.
I do think of time management as a well-being strategy, but it is one with limited potential. An academic psychiatrist who I really admire, Shri Jensen, writes about burnout versus depression, and maybe these are actually the same syndrome. And in his review of the burnout literature, he comes to the conclusion that it's really workload that is the main driver of burnout for most people. And organizations really need to understand that to make adjustments in workload expectations for individuals, that we can't just expect individuals to find a new well of time management strategies in order to meet the increasing productivity demands. So it's both, you know, time management can be so helpful, but how do you increase your distress tolerance around closing a chart when you've written the note at maybe 80% of its speed? You know, how do you tolerate letting some undone things live on the to-do list, but you're still going to close up your computer and go home and be with your family? But organizations really play a key role in understanding what's driving burnout when it comes to workload and not overburdening the individual on figuring out how to just accept the new reality and make it happen while still being able to thrive.
Yeah, I'll echo that from my own personal experience. You know, boy was I good at time management. like I said earlier, I think one of my issues came from just not having any slack in the system when something arose that required a little bit of additional time to address. I've also been thinking to your question earlier, Dr. Yam, about, you know, what are some useful interventions and what can be harmful. I wouldn't call these harmful, but maybe more superficial, the kind of, you know, 1 hour wellness workshops that institutions put on. I think they come from a good place. And maybe there are folks out there that find those to be a nice break from the workday and valuable. I think putting kind of money behind the initiative is important. And I just want to give a shout out to my own institution that I'm at currently. They have a wellness center that's funded by the institution that's solely internally facing. It's staffed by therapists. And the only people that go there are the faculty and staff of the institution and medical students and other health profession students. So the therapists that are available are solely for the institution's employees and learners. And that was really valuable for me. It was kind of made me feel that the institution did care and that there were resources being put behind the wellness initiatives. And so that's something I would bring up for any institutional leaders that might be listening to this to consider having an inward-facing wellness center with therapists available for individuals to seek out help when needed.
Yeah, that's such a substantial commitment, isn't it? It really shows some resources being dedicated, which I think is part of the message. Last question for everybody. How do you think modern burnout differs now in 2026 than previously? And do you think individuals or leaders within institutions or our community or our profession need to learn different skills to help with modern burnout?
Dr. Yam, that's such a fascinating question. I do think the demands on healthcare professionals are different today than they were in decades past. The EHR, the productivity expectations, resource constraints are different. I think the individuals are different as well. I do think we have been evolving in a very positive way to this place of increased understanding and acceptance of distress and mental health concerns. I think the conversation is much more on the forefront, and I feel really relieved and happy about that. I think that we are still lagging a little bit around help seeking. We're acknowledging, yes, burnout is common in healthcare. I think the next step is really, okay, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to try to prevent this? And how do we treat it when it does show up? And Dr. Golden's comment about internal resources, I think that's really critical. And I feel proud to be at OHSU that has a very robust, similar program that is highly utilized, but that's not available to all healthcare providers. So how do we increase access and increase encouragement to help seeking, reduce the stigma, reduce some of the fear about what that means for folks?
Yeah, I would say that in today's, they call it the attention economy. The iPhone didn't exist until about just under 20 years ago. Email is relatively new, and with regards to human evolution, the number of inputs and ways that physician and healthcare provider attention is being pulled is very difficult to manage for, I think, a lot of people. And I guess that's a question for organizational leaders, is how can we protect physicians and healthcare professionals' attention so that they're not pulled in 20 directions at once, which I think can lead to stress and anxiety and burnout. I talk in my essay about the number of ways that I can be contacted and that I'm expected to monitor all of these different variable ways that I can be reached out to, both from patients, but also from my peers and colleagues and coworkers. And I think maybe some low-hanging fruit would be to figure out how can we reduce the number of inputs that are coming to us so that our attention is protected.
Occupational psychologists have this term, work intensification, which is pretty obvious. It just means how much work are people being asked to do? And as I mentioned earlier, what we're seeing in surveys, and it's not just in the medical or healthcare professions, it's actually sort of across the board, across many professions, but it is especially in the healthcare professions that people are being asked to shoulder the workload of what perhaps two people would have shouldered not too long ago. And I think there's many contributors to that, but I think one of them is what Dr. Golden was talking about, the attention economy. It used to be that when we left work, there weren't that many ways that people could get a hold of us. Now we can often fully do at least a huge part of our job from home. So there is no sort of natural work-life separation. So I think we need to be, and I hate that it falls partly on us, but it does, whether we like it or not. I think all of us as professionals need to be really intentional about cultivating all of the things that we've been talking about during this podcast, including self-kindness and self-compassion, including perhaps spiritual practices, including time management, including hope, and seeking sources of self-care and sources of mental health for all of us personally, I think it takes an intentional effort in a way that perhaps it didn't just a couple of decades ago. And that's not mutually exclusive, and it should not be mutually exclusive with our healthcare systems and our employers asking the question, how do we lighten workloads? How do we provide resources that actually take some of the burden off of professionals? I think these two things can and should be explored in parallel.
So I do have one very specific question that this is bringing up for me. What do you think about these reports that physicians now get on their own performance? I think about all the ways that physicians are now rated. So we have these patient surveys that are now publicly available on the web. We have these relative value unit reports that describe your financial productivity in your practice recently. We have various performance indicators, such as your time to do certain tasks or your completion level. And physicians are now getting all these reports. And I think there is a good impulse behind it, which is quality improvement and transparency and giving people information about how to do that on an individual level. But I do wonder about the effect of that. What do you think, Dr. Golden? How did you feel about those kind of things, which are becoming so universal now in every radiation oncology practice?
I do think that the RVU reports, for example, gets to what Dr. Feldman's speaking about with work intensification, that there's an idea that we are in the end here to be productive. And if we're underproductive in some measurable domain, that we need to increase our productivity. And maybe organizations need to be okay with us as physicians or healthcare professionals not always being optimally productive, because to accomplish that, it gets back to the idea of kind of there's no slack in the system. If the perfect doctor sees X number of RVUs or generates X number of RVUs per year, you know, as humans, we're naturally going to be imperfect, and we may not be able to achieve that. And so that is a layer of stress. The question about patient assessments of physicians is interesting. I, to date, haven't been somewhere where that's been a major part of my practice. I think I looked at my webpage recently and I only had one review, and fortunately it was 5 out of 5 stars. So for whatever reason, I'm not generating a lot of reviews, but I know there are other practices out there where that's a major part of kind of their performance assessment. But I think organizations need to be careful to think about what are those reviews actually measuring, and is that what we want to be rating physicians on, at least internally? And do we want to add that additional burden of pressure to physicians?
You know, there are a couple of sayings that come up in my mind. And one of the sayings is, what gets measured gets managed. And I think that when we measure something, it takes on a kind of reality. We have to then address it. But there's a simultaneous saying, which I'm sure you've heard of, which is, not everything that counts can be counted. And not everything that can be counted counts. And so I think I would really agree with what Dr. Golden said. I think healthcare organizations need to think about not only what are the primary effects that they want to achieve by measuring these things, which is obviously quality and productivity improvement, but what are the unintentional side effects of this? How is it then leading people to be burned out, and perhaps in the long term, leading people to drop out of the profession, leading to lower productivity of people because they're burned out or depressed or hopeless, or even leading to increased medical errors in the long run? I think that oftentimes we think about the short-term consequences of measuring these kinds of things, but not the long-term consequences. And then I think this idea that not everything that counts can be counted, I think it's also important for us to counterbalance these kinds of measures in our own life by doing some of the self-temperature checks we were talking about earlier, of spending some time with ourselves, kind of informally rating ourselves. How is my mental health? How is my sense of meaning and purpose and hope and joy in life? And figuring that in, at least in our own personal lives, into how we make choices.
I deeply agree with both what Dr. Feldman and Golden are saying on this topic and the concern that you're expressing, Dr. Yam, that these types of measures do have some risk for the individual clinician for burnout and resentment and attrition. I also wonder if we might be using data in a different way that could actually contribute to a win-win situation. For instance, considering RVU or productivity data, not just from the lens that more is better, but how could we maybe better understand what the ideal productivity is for a clinician so that they are doing really excellent work, they're having positive patient outcomes, and they're thriving, you know, that those additional measures may help us understand better targets for productivity that aren't as black and white as, you know, the more patients you can see, the more money you can earn for your organization, the better. But using some of this data that we're collecting, not just in the spirit of taking care of the financial bottom line, but also to help taking care of our workforce. On the topic of patient satisfaction surveys, I think this is a common source of stress for many, many clinicians for sure. And I do think we just need to be really careful about why are we measuring patient satisfaction? What are we trying to get at? And are we sure, like Dr. Feldman suggested, that we're actually getting at that in the best way with this one measure? You know, there are some things that maybe are going to be very difficult to measure when it comes to excellent patient care that aren't just limited to patient satisfaction. So being very mindful about what is our goal in collecting this data, are we sure that how we're doing it is accomplishing that goal? And what are the costs of measuring the data in the way that we're measuring?
Yeah, I'll add a personal anecdote to that I often run late seeing my patients, but it's because I'm often with a patient beforehand who needs extra time. And I've had patients tell me over the years that they're okay that I'm late because they know if they need to talk to me that I will spend the time that they need. And they understand that if I was late, it was because I was with someone else that needed more time. And if we put a measure on that and it was just, is Dr. Golden on time, you might actually be missing that aspect of my practice, which is that I give time to patients when they need it, even if it means I'm late for my next patient. So I think that's just a single anecdote to support you know, not everything that counts should be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. So
I so relate to that story, Dr. Golden, because I actually heard my medical assistants having an argument in the hall. One of them was mad because I was late, and then the other one was saying, no, it's because she spent a lot of time with that patient. She spends a lot of time with them. So I just so fundamentally relate to that. It was funny for me to overhear an actual debate happening in real time in my clinic hallway. I love the suggestions here, and I'm just going to sort of summarize them from my understanding. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because I think these are so important, which is the focus on the ultimate goal and the actual outcome, you know, which is what we all want, benefit to the patients and higher quality of care, and not so much the process and the metrics that we use to get there, right? In other words, what Dr. Feldman was saying about, you know, what counts isn't the measurement, what counts is the goal and the outcome. And then also the emphasis that all of you placed on how we should maybe think about setting targets and ranges. I've never seen that in any of these metric assessments. You know, I've never seen anyone actually say, well, excessively over the top performance should be equally concerning and equally a focus of correction, and that excess may point to something that we actually don't want on this. I've never, ever seen that. And some of the, I think, frustration that physicians feel with these metrics is that there's no end. There's no top level, right? We can only just get better and better and better, as Dr. Soller was saying. So I just want to emphasize what I understood from that exchange, because I think that's so valuable for leaders to hear. And thank you for sharing that. Any last comments or stories or experiences you'd like to share related to burnout?
I was thinking back to your earlier question towards the beginning of this about hobbies and what I find valuable in them. And throughout the discussion, it kind of made me think that there are actually opportunities for me to practice self-compassion and hope. Every time I step up to hit a golf ball or start a piece of pottery, I'm hopeful that it will turn out well. And many times it doesn't, and then I have to practice self-compassion. And I think, this is a less high-stakes scenario than what we deal with in clinical practice, but kind of having that opportunity in my life just to practice some hope and self-compassion in a less high-stakes environment, I think is maybe therapeutic in its own way. And then with that in mind, if somebody is feeling burned out or concerned about feeling burned out, I'm not suggesting that you just pick up a hobby and that will fix things, but maybe that's a question to ask yourself is, do I have time to do something for myself, like a hobby that I enjoy, or taking time for spirituality, or spending time with my family? And if you don't have the time to do that, maybe that's a sign that your fish tank is overfull, or you don't have any slack in the system, and maybe you need to do a deeper check on and why are you here, and what are your driving forces? Where's your agency coming from? And maybe you need a deeper reset than just a simple wellness workshop or picking up a hobby.
Well, with that really important comment, I feel compelled now to just turn to that concern for anyone out there listening who feels like they're on the edge of burnout or maybe going over the edge. Dr. Soller or Dr. Feldman, any just quick suggestions or immediate interventions you'd recommend?
Well, I think it's important for everybody to know that there are crisis resources. The National Helpline is 988, and you can call or text anytime to talk to somebody about what you're experiencing and get connected with resources. You may also have resources through your institutions. You can call your insurance and look for an in-network provider. Your employer might have an employee assistance program. There's a physician hotline as well. So there's a lot of help out there. That's not to say it doesn't take effort and energy to get connected with services when they're necessary. And so asking for help, even with that piece, can be really helpful, important as well. But I think what we're talking about here is really, recognizing that these are very challenging jobs, and we will all hit a point, even with the best of intentions and the best self-care practices, where we might hit a wall and we need some help, and that it, hopefully we're increasing the sense of permission that it's okay to ask for that
And that you are not alone. I think that's also something that I hope comes across to all listeners, particularly if they're feeling burnt out, that this is so common, that you are not alone, even if it's not talked about very much. I think everyone experiences this at some time or another, and it is not a measure of your worth as a human being or your effectiveness. Actually, I think we all need to take time to care for ourselves, and that doing that doesn't make you ineffective, it makes you effective. So be kind to yourself and know that you're struggling with something that probably lots of people around you are, whether it's talked about a lot or not.
What an incredibly rejuvenating and compassionate conversation we've just had. Thank you so much to each of you for your wisdom and the really generous sharing of your experiences. I really enjoyed this discussion, which went so immediately to the foundational issues underlying wellness and did such a great job of reminding all of us about the importance of taking care of ourselves. Your contributions were so instructive and valuable to my own life. And I'm hoping our listeners and readers will find the same. I encourage everyone to take a look at the wonderful articles that have been written in our Real Talk on Wellness section and to sort of keep track of that as we continue to progress in this interesting experiment at the journal. Hopefully, we get some positive results and feedback from that. Congratulations to all of you here on the podcast for your high quality publications. I really thank you for your support of our RTOW section. And especially your commitment to making the world a more humane and lovable place.
Thank you, Dr. Yam. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for doing this podcast, and thank you for the section.
Thank you to all of you for the incredible work you're doing. I think we are changing the culture in each of our individual ways.
Well, what a hopeful and uplifting message to end on. This has been a podcast from the Rudd Journal. The Rudd Journal is Astra's premier journal for original laboratory and clinical investigations related to radiation oncology, radiation biology, medical physics, and both education and health policy as they relate to the field.